forget you. But now they won't forget you. The crowd is gonna seep out in the hate.
Going here, so I'll just throw out the questions and whomever would like to address it. So what do you make of what happened in court today?
I wasn't even in there because what we're trying to do is get this court to operate under common law, and so we need to invoke that the Queen's Bench so we can operate under common law, because we're...
All right, you're listening to Language to Language, and this is CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan. I'm going to be your host today on Language to Language, and I have two special guests in here. One is Shannon Hecker, who's going to talk to us about the Omnibus March and other things that are happening in our community. Plus, we also have Ambrose Williams from Alive, A.L.I.V.E., and he is going to talk about a couple of initiatives that are happening with the Parks Board, and also his journey on the big roadblock. And we'll be right back. But first of all, I'd like to play for you an audio file that was sent to me from Kootenai Radio and Co-op Radio by Catherine Fisher. And she's telling us the background information on the Sinaiks people. Most recently, they were denied their injunction, and as a result, two of the people still sitting on the blockade, Marilyn Dennis and another person, got arrested. So here it is on 101.9 FM CITR.
This court to operate under common law, and so we need to invoke that the Queen's Bench so we can operate under common law, because... Sinaiks have their own society, and that's a society that's outside of Canada, so the only way to really meet that society is at that level of common law. And so we're just trying to invoke those basic rights that we all have to self-determination and self-governance. And we submitted a letter to the registry, but obviously the judge never got it.
What did the letter say?
It's a private letter, so I can't talk about that.
Marilyn, you're suggesting, though, that people will be back on Perry Ridge tomorrow?
Yes, I am. And I think we're actually standing in a very lawful place. I'm a Sinaiaxt woman within Sinaiaxt territory, acting upon my responsibilities within Sinaiaxt society. And as a Sinaiaxt person, I have to uphold what I am told to do and what are my responsibilities to my society as a Sinaiaxt woman. And not only as a Sinaiaxt woman, as Mum'im, which is one of the two laws that govern us, that we believe in.
For those who haven't heard or don't understand, what is the issue on Perry Ridge? Why are the Sinaiaxt blocking that road?
That is, and you know, again, it's constant them talking about blockades and trying to make us criminals, when we were told in the last court case, the Attorney General and BC Forestry lied in front of that three panel of judges and said there would be no more development on Perry's Ridge. So we went up there to do healing ceremonies, to start our cultural practices, to continue our way of being, keeping the lake's way, keeping the Sinaiaxt way. And now it's because they lied, and we're doing our cultural practice as is required by us, they're trying to turn us into criminals. And we stand on our basic human rights as Sinaiaxt people who have a way. And we are self-determined and we are self-governing. And we have a right to that as human beings in Canada. And because we have been declared extinct by the Canadian government, we do not have any other avenues to approach the court other than common law.
What are you most concerned about on Perry Ridge if the logging goes ahead or if the road building goes ahead, or is it just a lack of consultation that you're concerned
about? It's the destruction of our way of being. It's a destruction of a cultural practice. It is an act of genocide. That's the problem I have with it.
And that's what we're trying to do. It's been made aware. Like, public knows that what Sinaiaxt are trying to do on Perry Ridge is to like maintain and revitalize our cultural practices. And so that ridge, because it connects, it's surrounded by pit house sites, pictograph sites, like all these areas that clearly show that it is like Sinaiaxt land, like, and was extremely used, like all levels of it. And there's stuff that everybody's ignoring, doesn't care, because it's not their culture, it's our culture, and so we have to protect it. And so we are trying to do these cultural things for like children, not only Sinaiaxt children, but to help educate like children in Canadian society.
So archaeological, that's one of the key things you're concerned about, that sites may be lost.
Yeah,
well,
like that's
the major site that is right below at Lemon Creek on the Perry's Ridge side has been documented by archaeologist Dr. Nathan Goodale, and that pit house site was carbon dated at 12,500 years old. That's how long our society has been operating in our Tumulau, on our unseceded territory. And we will continue to act that way through our responsibilities to our people, and stand on our responsibilities to our self-governance and our way of conducting ourselves culturally and as human beings who are responsible to our entire Tumulau and everything in it, including you.
Given what we heard in court today, Do you imagine that? I mean, it sounds like there's a great reluctance for the police or the Crown to press charges or to move in. Do you have any thoughts of what might happen tomorrow or in the coming days?
Well, you know what? I'm really afraid of police. The way that police have been rampantly acting and assaulting people and harassing people, that's why I called people up to witness, because we don't know what to expect. And that's not just Canadian police acting that way. That's police all around the globe. I would be stupid not to be fearful.
But you feel that it's important that you return there.
Yeah, it's as important as my next breath. It's as important as my next breath. I breathe culture. I inhale it. I exhale it. I live it. That's why it's important. If I couldn't practice my culture, I would cease being a human being.
And I just wanted to say, like, in terms of archaeology, like, whenever we speak of archaeology, it's kind of because we're trying to relate to somebody outside of the Senaiksa society, so we're using a word that they can relate with. Mm-hmm. But really, those are just our cultural sites.
Okay, so those are
they're not really archaeological sites to us. That's where our family lived and died and cried and prayed and ate and slept for generations and generations.
So what before the injunction application was granted, what was at the site? Did you have a group of people who were coming there every day, or what was going on there?
At the site, like, when the injunction was granted?
Yeah, until it was granted.
Because it's all snowy, and there's, you know, what are you going to do in the snow?
Okay, there was nothing.
So we were going up there and, like, spending time. People were going up and, like, praying for the land and going up and, you know, just spending time up there.
Doing vision quests. We had prayers going all the time.
And we have plans, because that road that they're building is on an old Indian trail across the whole ridge, mm-hmm. which that Indian trail got turned into a horse trail. Mm-hmm. That horse trail got turned into a forest fire service road. Now they want to turn it into an industrial road, even though all the public around them over the years have clearly stated that they do not wish to have that right of their natural resource exploited by some other for pure profit with no benefit to the public around that mountain. Mm-hmm. So I'm standing for my right. I'm standing for the rights of all Senaiks people, for all Salish people, for all Indigenous people in the province of British Columbia, because it is unceded territory. And by their law, we have to enter to them at a common law level and say, where is it that you got the right to control, govern, and take away these rights of people who have been trying to say that they are ours and you can't take them? Mm-hmm. You don't have a right. Mm-hmm. The courts don't have rights. They only have obligations and duties. Mm-hmm. They don't have rights. We have rights as human beings. And so that includes protecting water, protecting the animals. Like, it's like we live off the land to a degree that, like, in today's day and age, with all the trespass that's gone on in Senaiks territory, all the devastation and everything, there's no salmon. So this court, through its legislations, created policies that destroyed aspects of Senaiks culture that are at this point virtually irreparable unless they can get somebody with authority to actually follow their obligations. And that's not up to me. My right is just here to claim my right and to claim that I do not want to be determined by this courtroom to be somebody that I am not. I do not want to be subjected to the levels of this bureaucratic system that is just clearly shown to be deceitful and exploiting my rights. And they present it in a way like they're going to try and force us to come in by arresting us potentially, because the police are ignorant of laws and aren't actually understanding of how it's all supposed to be operating, and so they don't understand until they already commit those violations by detaining people or whatever, and then get before a judge, and a judge will say, oh, you violated this guy's rights. But the police will still sit there, and then what will that lead to except us having to seek remedies for being held and incarcerated against our free will, for not even committing a crime? Hey, get down. You almost fell. That would be scary. Come on. It's slippery.
We should go get coffee.
We're going to go get coffee.
Are you writing for a local paper?
Nelson Star, yeah.
So we're just really trying to invoke that common law, and that's what, like I said, to the clerks, like, I can't cross that bar because I don't identify as being part of your society. I'm operating under Sinaiic society. I'm not a person. I'm just a man. I'm a human being. And I can't go, I can't enter this court unless they're going to operate a common law. Because this court is only reserved for people who determine themselves to be different types of legal persons controlled by different jurisdictions. I just want to come and speak to another man at common law level, which this whole Canadian society is founded on this common law, and it parallels Sinaiic's laws, the Wuplakin and Smamim, of these basic laws where you don't harm other human beings, you don't harm the environment, you don't harm everything that gives you the sustenance, everything that Creator God put here before people. So if you believe in a creator, then you have to acknowledge that common law is that level where when you come into common law, you sit before God. You sit before the Queen's Bench in front of God, under God's laws and the natural laws for humans that are ancient, and the society, this Canadian society, founded itself upon. And so now we're asking them, then, if you want to engage this man and that woman, the Sinaiic's people, then you need to come to that level where we can actually deal with it. And it's very common. They talk about it all throughout all sorts of law and stuff. But at common law, legislation doesn't go into common law, because common law is the foundation, and then the next foundation of law is statutes and acts and whatnot. So if they can't meet us on this level, then they can't include us in this level. Because this is my belief, and you'll never change my belief. This is the way, my customs.
Like,
yeah, it's not even. Yeah, it's just our beliefs, and you can't change people's beliefs. We have proof that this is Sinaiic's territory, that this is Sinaiic's land. Sinaiic's family should have their rights here. They shouldn't have to worry about police coming and arresting them because they're saying, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! You're gonna go and trash like more of our cultural sites." Like, this is where we live. We live on this mountain. We live at the base of the mountain. All right, and this is the mountain that we use. This is Frog Mountain. This area around, like, the drainages coming from the Little Slocan and Slocan. Like, that name Slocan is Slucane, like for meaning like pierced in the head, right?
Yeah.
And these are all things that verify the land. So then if we're going to come here, we have to come at that level where we can actually be treated as equals, because we're not being treated as equals if we go into the Supreme Court of BC acting as a legal person. So I'm just here acting as a human being with basic rights that are guaranteed to me. I'm not even supposed to be having to defend myself, and really I should just be in here setting a claim to seek remedy for these violations that have taken place against me and my family.
Okay.
And it's a, yeah, they may know it. A lot of the court clerks and stuff seem confused, but the judges know exactly what we're talking about. They know common law. And we can't answer. I'm not the person on that list.
Yeah.
I view myself as being somebody entirely different. They're trying to make up somebody there and attach me to it. And I spoke what I just spoke to you, to the clerk, and then she told me right back that I couldn't even file the papers because I'm not on the list.
Mm-hmm. So you don't know whether it got to, did she take it? Do you know if it got to the judge?
I eventually got it in on the third try. I got somebody to stamp it at the registry when... Okay. But they were just trying to talk me out of it the whole time. I said, I just need to get a private letter to the judge in this regard. I need to invoke common law.
Yeah.
I can't operate in this courtroom.
Okay. Dennis, can I check?
All right. So this is Language to Language, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. It's 20 past 2. We just heard an interview by Greg Nesteroff, who did an interview with Marilyn and Dennis on Monday after the first court date, which happened here in Vancouver, and which was to try to get the injunction against the Sinaiics overturned. The judge refused, and then Marilyn James and Dennis Zarelli were arrested the next day, which was on a Tuesday at 8:30 a.m. They went before the Supreme Court by video conference from Nelson Courthouse at 5 p.m., Tuesday, and then they have a sentencing on Monday. March 17th. My goodness, on St. Patrick's Day. And so Marilyn James and, you know, that this situation, the Sinaiks people have been in trying to, first of all, prove that they're not extinct and that they are the rightful people to consult over the land, has been a 20-year journey for them, and only to find themselves in jail? Come on. So today what we're talking about is in solidarity with all land defenders. And we have Ambrose Williams, who was on the front lines of the blockade at Elsa Poktauk in the Mi'kmaq territory, and he's going to share his experience with us. He is a member of Alive, which is an urban organization in Vancouver. And we also have Shannon Hecker in the house, and she, my friends, is going to be talking to us about many things, primarily in solidarity with all land defenders. And we also have Woody Morrison in the house with us today. I'm so excited. I haven't seen him for so long. I missed him. But in the meantime, we're going to play some music, and we'll be right back after this. It's gonna go up,
state of your spirits today. This is Woody. I don't get in here very often. I've been kind of working, and I've got to run here in a few minutes to go back to work. But anyway, I've been listening to all the things that have been going on and watching. I've been involved in a lot of these environmental fights now for the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years. And some of the things we're fighting against is you cannot fight something that does not exist. A corporation doesn't exist. Nobody's ever seen one. It's a ghost. It's a contrivance on paper that's supposed to protect someone's assets, but they hide behind it. And so when we take a look at what's going on here, as a matter of policy, the Crown declared that the English common law does not apply when it's dealing with the title to native lands. I don't like the word First Nations because it has too many implications. But anyway, so what that means is that under the English common law, a flawed title never improves with the passage of time. So if I steal your car and sell it to someone and that other person sells it and so on and so on, you have the best title because mine starts out flawed. But that doesn't apply when it's native lands. You can steal our lands and sell it despite the fact you have a flawed title because you don't recognize my title as being legitimate. And so when Governor Douglas, the governor was not a political person, a political head of government. A governor was a CEO of a corporation called a colony. So he simply had the land surveyed and started selling it. And this is what happened. And on the East Coast, in 1761, the king got tired of all these CEOs making private deals with Indians to get land. You know, their daughters would marry an Indian guy, and through that they would get land, or their son married an Indian woman. Well, the king got tired of that and issued the Royal Proclamation of 1761, which went from Florida all the way up to somewhere around Massachusetts, somewhere in that area. And what it did was it forbid any crown subject from going beyond the headwaters of any river flowing into the Atlantic Ocean upon our royal displeasure, that only the crown could alienate title. In other words, that the crown head of England or the United Kingdom was the only legitimate one that could deal with his nations of indigenous peoples, and you as an individual could not. And then in 1763, it was extended to go on, you know, up into what's now Canada. And so when people argue and say that First Nations or Native occupancy began with the Royal Proclamation of 1763, well, it would have had the same legal effect if that king had said, all the lands east of the English Channel are hereto reserved to the French. It would have had no legal effect. So the crown had no legal authority to reserve those lands for Indians. And so here we are fighting those battles today. And what we've done is we've become so assimilated that we're playing the game ourselves. I listened to Wab Kanu. Mm-hmm. He was talking on this Eighth Fire about, in some ways, our real our future lies in our willingness to deal with these white government people if we are to share in the bounty of the land, is how he said it. In other words, we've got to become assimilated, play the game. In one of his episodes, he was brought in a family, a comedian guy with his family. They're sitting down having wine with dinner and all these other trappings. And there was nothing in there that really said anything about who we are as humans. Now, when the Mi'kmaq were confronting the police, they were yelling at them, you speak our language. This is our country. You speak Mi'kmaq. Speak Mi'kmaq. And they started yelling back in English and French. So we can't refer to the trees, the fish, the minerals. We can't refer to them as resources. Those are our relatives. It's not just the land. That's real estate. That's something for sale. You women, you children, you are commodities. You're like real property to be bought and sold. And they don't care about your rights because you have no value other than what they can sell you for. And so we have to change that so that our women and children are no longer resources. Our children are not our greatest resource. That's my relatives. I got to love them and protect them. Those women that get protected, they're not abused. You're beating the hell out of them. You're killing them. Forget the euphemisms. You're killing them. You're beating them. You're torturing them. Residential school, get rid of that word because it was never intended to be a school. Take a look at what happened electrocutions, torture, beating, raped, all those things went on, and we call it abuse. And then you come and you get a commission, and then the guy who writes up the assessment for the Crown, they refuse to play it. So when we start looking at all these things that are going on, and I heard on this when they're talking about which is the best book for Canada, and Wab Kanoo was saying that Canada faces two great problems. I forget what the first was, but the second one is how can we develop the tar sands safely? It's too late for that. They've already polluted that whole 600-mile radius area. So it's too late for that. And also, I grew up as what people call a history keeper. And our history told of this time that's here now, all this weather, all the climate change that's coming. We can't stop it, but we sure as heck can speed it up with all the cloud seeding that's going on here, the United States, China, Russia. Major countries are cloud seeding to keep the weather away from their crops. And so they're speeding it up. But what do we do? How do we survive it? We have to stop thinking of ourselves as individuals. Okay, I am an individual, but I have a society. I have a language. I have a people. I have a land. We have to start trusting each other again and sharing. Residential schools said, don't trust anybody. Look out for number one. I don't trust my brother. I don't trust my sister. They're just trying to rip me off. So we've been trained to believe that. Money is personal power. Wealth is responsibility to share. We were wealthy people until they gave us money. And so now look at us. So anyway, that's my rave for right now. Now I got to run out in the rain and cool off. And, cool my jets.
Cool
you know,
your jets, Woody.
You know the one
it's getting
thing
hot
that
in here.
One of the things I try not to do is to take myself seriously. I start doing it. Well, one of the things the old man told me, he says, you know, Guna, you know, dear boy, anytime you start thinking that you are indispensable. Just remember, the graveyards are full of indispensable people. So everybody has a role to play. Mm-hmm. And whether it's with what you're trying to do about decolonizing Turtle Island, then the question becomes of if suddenly we're decolonized, what are we going to look like? What are we going to do? How are we going to be different? So that's my question.
What's it going to look like?
How, are you asking me?
Yeah, come on.
Well, I think if you want to talk about decolonization, you need to start off with yourself and decolonize your mind. And that doesn't just go for Native people. That goes for non-Natives alike. As you said, that we all have this Western ideology that, you know, you got to be an individual. You got to take care of yourself. And really, we really need to start taking care of each other. So it's really about, you know, thinking differently. And it's going to take a lot of unlearning because the residential schools aren't the only place where people are conditioned to think a certain way. It's all the schools. It's a...
Yeah, so we're listening to Shannon Hecker as she responds to Woody Morrison's commentary. And she's from an anthropology student at UBC involved in organizing many community events. Recently, on March 1st, she was the coordinator of the Omnibus March in cooperation with Worldwide March against the government corporations. And then again on May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, she will be organizing a worldwide family gathering in solidarity. And so do you have any comments, Ambrose Williams, about Woody's commentary?
Yeah, definitely. I was actually waiting to jump in.
Okay. Rip that mic out of our hands.
I can see where Wab Kanoo's coming from, just because I'm an urban Aboriginal that grew up in the city. And if you look at the statistics, over 2/3 of our population live off-reserve with no political representation. So how do we reclaim our space within the cities? We're not living on reserve. We don't have any voting rights when it comes to anything, land grabs, resource extraction, anything along those lines within our own chief and council, just because they're not reaching out to us. There's no provincial accountability to the chiefs and council. I mean, as an individual member within a band, I can't go out to the local band office and say, my discourse for the politician there, but it's also done on a federal level. I can't go to the AFN and voice my disconcern there. It's only the chiefs and council. We don't elect the chiefs and council across the country. It's within the AFN. The AFN is composed of basically 600-plus chiefs across the country that represent the bands, and we and you're only allowed to vote if you're a chief within the AFN structure. So I have it all comes down to who represents basically the urban indigenous voice. We're the fastest growing population in the country right now. So how do you harness that youthful energy and bring our voices to the table? So I could see where Wab Canoe is coming from.
Well, what I would suggest is here in Vancouver, we have probably the largest mix of Aboriginal peoples. And what we're doing here is a lot of it's free. But instead of organizing gangs, you can start finding out who your clan is. And once you can start identifying who your clan is and your clan relatives, this begins to change that power structure. Now, the AFN is really an arm of the federal government, as are the band councils, because they're complete creations of federal legislation. Uh-huh. So to become part of it, you got to be part of that machine. And if you're going to start looking at how do we survive this thing, like, for example, we're doing things here in Vancouver. I have a friend who's Anishinaabe, and he does what's called Indigifit. In other words, we are hardwired to be physically fit. And so there's a lot of little ways in which that can be done, and that's what he's doing. I'm working with a group that's it's an art mentoring program, and my job is the storyteller to pass on the cultural values. And the cultural values are quite different from what they were told about the Europeans. In fact, even our chiefs, in Haida, you cannot, you're a boss, but you can't give orders. Only European chiefs can. And also, we follow our mother's side. And so long as I know who my mother is, then I know who all my relatives are. But if I know just my father, then it ends right there. And so what we're doing also is we're teaching not only the art, but what are the values that go into it. For example, say you're weaving a hat. The first thing we start with is you begin with a story. You start weaving a story into that hat, your story, because only you can tell your story. You have to be committed to that story. If you're not, it's going to turn out to be a big mess. But you have to have enough courage to stick to your story. And also you have to be honest to tell your story truly and have the integrity to tell the truth even though nobody's looking.
Kind of so, like what Marilyn James and this Dennis guy did from Sinaix, right? Yeah. They stuck to their story for those 20 years. They're not giving up on it. And as she said, she will not stop until, like, she takes her last breath, literally, right?
So that's what we're talking about. We've got a lot of these programs. Like, I teach, volunteer teach Haida language and culture. And a lot of the young people, not a lot, but the young people from the community policing program come in here. And some of them say, well, we're not going to school. And I tell them, well, not everybody should be in school. But that doesn't mean you have to be ignorant. Read things, listen to people, watch, learn, because education is a product we're trying to buy. Coming to knowledge is something you do for your entire life. And once you can start seeing yourself and all those other things as your family, those trees are your grandmothers, those stars are your relatives, that gold, silver, that's your grandfathers, the water, that's first medicine, that's life. And so when you can start changing your perception, see, the difference between us and the blacks is we never wanted a piece of the action. The black people were brought to North America, and they had nothing else but to be the one that gets to work in the big house, the ones who can get a piece of the action because they got nothing else. We wanted to be left alone, but they won't ever leave us alone. So when you live in a city, you can either start finding out who you are, finding out your history, your culture, or just be simply labeled a Walmart hunter, you know, or a Safeway hunter. I mean, me, you know, that's what I've become. I do all my
While you were talking, I was looking at an article here, extracts from a speech given by Jerry Gamble at the Conference of Human Rights at Tobique Reserve in New Brunswick. And this happened in 1958, and in this speech we were warned that Native people about how society goes about taking away the human rights of Native people. And I think you addressed a lot of this during your commentary, mm-hmm. but I will just reinforce it. With the art of stealing human rights, the art of denying Indians their human rights has been refined for a science. The following list of commonly unique techniques will be helpful in burglar-proofing your reserves and your rights. Gain the Indian's cooperation. It is easier to steal someone's rights if you can do it with his own cooperation. And I think that's when you talk about what Wabkinew is now doing, it may be pertinent to
that's part of it.
To it. Part of it.
It didn't make him a bad guy. No, just step in.
No, this is like critical thinking, right? Yeah. I mean, we can't just swallow everything we're told, even if it is a First Nations person telling us.
Well, see, some of these
I'm just going to move on with these points, okay? One, make him a non-person. Human rights are for people. Convince Indians their ancestors were savages, that they were pagan, that Indians were drunkards, and make them wards of the government. Make a legal distinction, as in the Indian Act, between Indians and persons. Write history books and tell half the story. They've done that, right? Number two, convince the Indian that he should be patient, that these things take time. Tell him that we are making progress and that progress takes time. You don't know how many times I've been told that, even by my own people. Make him believe that things are being done for his own good. Tell him you're sure that after he has experienced laws and actions that he will realize how good they have been. Tell the Indian he has to take a little off the bad, in order to enjoy the benefits you are conferring on them. And then four, get some people to do their dirty work. There are always those who will act for you to the disadvantage of their own people. Just give them an honor and give them some praise. And this is generally the function of band council chiefs and advisory councils, and they have little legal power, but can handle the tough decisions such as welfare allocation and housing. Four, consult with the Indian, but do not act on the basis of what you hear. Tell the Indian he has a voice and go through the motions of listening. Then interpret what you have heard and suit your own needs. Number six, you can insist that Indians go through the proper channels. Make the channels and the procedures so difficult that he won't bother to do anything. When he discovers the proper channels and becomes proficient and at the procedures, all you got to do is change them. Number seven, make the Indians believe you are working for him, putting in much overtime and a great sacrifice, and imply that he should be appreciative. This is the ultimate in skills in stealing human rights, when you obtain the thanks of the victim. Number eight, allow a few individuals to make the grade and point to them of examples. Say that hard workers and the good Indians have made it, and that therefore it is a person's own fault if he doesn't succeed. Nine, appeal to the Indian's sense of fairness and tell him that even though things are pretty bad, it is not right for him to make strong protests. Keep the argument going on his form and protest and avoid talking about the real issue. Refuse to deal with him while he is protesting and take all the fire out of his efforts. And number 21, one of the last things you can do is hold a conference on human rights, have everyone blow off some steam and tension, and go home feeling like everything is fine. So we're...
Well, see, what she was reading was actually published in the 1840s by white slave owners on how to achieve and maintain slavery. One of them was to, if I can convince you that what's in my best interest is also in your best interest, I can get you to do anything I want without hardly any pressure. If I can convince you that the white man is always supposed to be in charge and that color is a badge of degradation, you know, I can get you to do anything. But anyway, they actually published these five principles. And when we started looking at them, and you talk about decolonization. Decolonization is a whole bunch of things. Mm. For example, one of the things I argue about is, why do we say sacred fire? Why do we say sacred water? If you take a look at what that word means in English, that means there's something there that you have to worship. Mm. Mm-hmm. We didn't worship. We treated everything with very high esteem. And so when you start looking at the words they're using, see, I've had the misfortune of going and getting a law degree and a couple of other degrees, but I was trained by the old people. And so I could have got on a fast lane with everybody else, but I chose not to, because these things are too important. And I'm glad to see that you're willing to stand to argue with me. Even, you know, we don't always have to agree on anything. Just because we don't agree doesn't mean that you're wrong or I'm right or whatever. So
I don't know if I was necessarily disagreeing with you. Maybe it just sounded that way.
No, I was talking
about him.
Oh, okay, good. So on that note, I wanted to just sort of explain about this society that we've created in solidarity with all land defenders. It's a page on Facebook, and one of the upcoming events actually kind of fits into everything we're talking about. We've created an online... It's an event scheduled to happen June 20th, but it's actually an online forum for people. It's called Impeach Sean Atleo, and it's basically touching on all those things. We created this event so that people could have an online discussion because, you know, we feel that the way that the whole system is designed is really just to add value to certain people in order to take advantage of the rest of the people. did you want to add anything to that?
No, not in terms of that, but I don't think Wap Kanu is advocating for assimilation. I met him in Ontario, and he's really... Like, what I see him saying is basically, it's time to move in on these systems, politically and in the community. We're always being pushed aside because we have no political standing. And it's basically, it's to come to this point, we're always co-opted by the government for, the whole noble savage idea. So why don't we co-opt the government, push in our own candidates, run our own people with our own policies to enact change, work within the system rather than being a victim of it?
Well, and... in many cases, you know, we could draw these lines about what's going on in the downtown east side with gentrification of the downtown east side. You know, there are people that are going to work with the developers and benefit from it, while the real people that actually live there are going to be the ones that are going to suffer. So, I mean, you can talk about people who have this privilege, right?
Yeah.
And then the people that don't. And so where do you stand? Do the people with privilege, are they always going to be the one that get to speak for everybody else?
No, I don't think so. And that's really what I've been trying, what we've been working towards, and I personally feel really passionate about, is creating spaces for people to have their voices on issues.
That's a really great Alive initiative.
Not just Alive, for a long time. But not just having a place for people to talk about things, actually creating space for people to get together and start doing things. And not even just, I mean, I am a member at large with Alive, but I mean, this is beyond Alive. I really would like to see people getting involved in it. And I know it's really difficult because there are so many people in survival mode, so it's hard to come in.
There are people who are fractured. I mean, how do you create solidarity between the forces, especially when we're actually working against each other?
It's something I'm really trying hard to work towards, and there's been a lot of obstacles, and I'm just going to keep working towards it, like the other lady said, and it's something that I really believe in, and I'm going to keep on working towards it, no matter how hard it seems. We just had this march, and, you know, there's 200 people showed up, and it was part of the nationwide march, omnibus march against Harper, but really it's not against Harper. It was part of a worldwide march against government corruption, which is, you know, doesn't matter if it's in the Indian Band Council or if it's the other government. There's corruption everywhere. Like you said, these people with privilege don't care about a lot of the people in many cases. And so it's really about getting all the people together, and that's hard because there is so much lateral violence. There's so many people fighting each other to get to the top. So I really, what I'm proposing is, like, people really need to start helping each other. And the way we can do that is think, you know, think globally, of course, but you need to really act within your local communities and stop fighting everyone, try to help people get together. There can be, you know, community gardens, things like that, working together, or buying your food together in wholesale and splitting it up And those are just really little small examples of how you can create and build community with people and start being able to trust the other people around you. And then, you know, it's evolving as I talk about it. The ideas keep coming to my head. Like, how do you get everyone together for solidarity? Solidarity is a really charged word. I mean, what is solidarity? Like, to me, solidarity is like we are one. We are all human. We are of one mind, we are of one spirit, and we need to act that way. People say it, and they think, oh, that's a nice idea, but do we do it?
Well, how do you do that when some are doing it, and everything they can, like you?
Yeah.
And yet there are people, even within your own little circle, or my own little circle, who aren't going to participate, no matter how much we jump up and down and scream our heads off or hug each other. I mean, how do we do this when we've been fractured since day one? Displaced, we've been like turning on each other left, right, and center. We have to build trust within our own community.
We do. And
well, from
it's
what
a hard, like a big bite that you just took off there,
yeah, no,
young
it
lady.
Is a big
and
bite.
I really appreciate that you want to continue to try and struggle for solidarity. You have an up-and-coming event in solidarity with all land defenders. Can you tell us about it?
Well, in solidarity with all land defenders is a page on Facebook, and there's a few upcoming events. For March 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, those 4 days, there's a worldwide awakening call. And there's the call is for people, local people, anyone. You don't have to be anyone special to organize an event wherever you are on the planet. And it's, like I said, March 1st through 4th. I've taken on the responsibility of organizing a march, an event, on the 3rd, which is a Saturday. And there's another lady who's going to organize some things.
Are you sure it's March?
No, sorry, May. Am I saying March? Yeah. May 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. March 1st was the one that
just
passed.
Yeah, that was big, right?
Yeah, and that was, it wasn't big, though. No? There was 200 people. It was big, it was worldwide, but there wasn't a lot of, I mean, more people need to come out, and so, like, that's exactly what you're saying. Like, it's great what I'm doing, and it feels great, and it's a good idea, but there's not that many people coming out. People really need to understand that we are powerful. The people are more stronger than all those people that are at the top of these government institutions. If everybody really did come out and get involved, then we'd be able to start getting rid of those fractures, because you'd see everybody together.
You would hear it, too.
You would hear it.
And you would feel it.
And you would feel it. Mm-hmm. And we felt that with 200 people on that. And so now there's upcoming May 3rd will be another march, and we're going to have space. People can come up and speak. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what you represent. You know, keep it respectful. But you can contact me, Shannon Hecker, on Facebook. And if you want to be involved in organizing, promoting, or you want to say something, then we would like to hear from you in solidarity with all land defenders on Facebook. And I know we're running out of time. So.
No, we're pretty good to go here. Okay. CITR is really flexible with their time.
Great.
We're in the middle of a fundraiser, actually, at CITR. And we want to own $35,000. If you can help me out, give us a call, 604-822-8648. You know, any amount of change is good.
Yeah.
Or some bills, you know, would be awesome. Or even your services. Maybe you'd like to give us a sponsorship. Maybe some food or some equipment or any number of things. You can do that here. Give us a call, 604-822-8648. And Ambrose Williams, you really didn't get much chance to talk. No. Let's let Rob Canoe rest and move on.
Yes.
Right? Some of the youth initiatives that you have. Charged is good. I mean, tension is good. People like to hear that. I mean, if we're all getting along, then why would we need to create solidarity within our people, right?
That's true.
So tell us more about this youth initiative program with the Parks Board.
Okay, so we're working on the Gen 7 program. Gen 7 program is in its simplest form, a practical approach to youth worker training in the community centers. So we get these young people working at the centers as youth workers. We're currently in 8 centers right now. I don't have all of them on me right now, but mainly on the East Vancouver. And the goal is to get them working in within the Parks Board as union employees, and then they could leverage that for more jobs in the future. We're on our second term right now. First one, we're in 5 centers, and 3 out of those 5 youth are now full-time employees within the center.
That's excellent. Which center is that? I missed that part.
We're in 8 right now, mainly on East Vancouver, so I don't have them all on me. I didn't mention that. Yeah.
For the Parks Board and Recreational.
Yeah. And it's basically like reclaiming your spot within the community centers.
Yeah.
We're always segregated to these Aboriginal-only focus programs, VACFAS, ANYA, Friendship Center. And what we're saying is basically, you know what? We don't grow up in those centers. We don't grow up in those programs. We grow up in our communities. And in order for true reconciliation, we need to be taking back those spaces and using them for our own programs and not be pushed aside.
I have to just...
Yeah? What's up?
Well, no, I was just going to say, like, I have to say this, sorry. When you talk about people being fractured, and true reconciliation is something that's really going to be really, really difficult. And I think saying true reconciliation is...
Oops, sorry.
It's just like, I think, you know, maybe that's almost really a strong goal. Like, I don't think we can ever really have true reconciliation, but we can always be healing.
Well, it's like the question that, you know, Woody asks, what does decolonization sound like?
Yeah.
And then alongside, we got to reconcile at the same time. How does that work, really?
No,
you know, is it going to work? I would hope so. I think that what I found from the idea of reconciliation is that it takes us reconciling with our own selves first and foremost. Like, you can't love anybody else unless you love yourself.
Exactly.
I've been hearing stories from a lot of people about their residential school survivors. The saddest one I heard most recently was from an older lady. Okay, get this. Because of residential school, she grew up with no love from her mom, her dad, her brothers, her sisters, her cousins. Anybody. Nobody gave her any loving whatsoever. Not even a hug, not a kiss, not even I love you, baby. Right? And then she grows up. She has children of her own. Right? 4 to 6 kids. And at one point, she hits one of the kids. And she calls the ministry on herself. And says, you got to take them. I'm going to hurt them. I don't trust myself.
Mm-hmm.
So she loses all of her kids to the system. Now, that makes it 2 generations. And now she's in her 60s, late 60s, 67. She doesn't have long to go. And she says, none of my kids love me. They won't even talk to me anymore. I try to contact them. I try to phone them and let them know how I feel and that I'm sorry. But they won't even return my calls. I email them, I text them, I get nothing. So not only is this woman growing up without love, she's also not loved by her own children and will most likely die unless she reconciles with herself, which is what she's working on right now. And then you have to reconcile with other people in your community and outside of that community. So we're faced with really interesting challenges here. There's going to be a lot of tension, not just in conversation, but in our families and outside of our families and communities as we try to struggle with decolonization alongside reconciliation. Scary stuff.
Yeah, I think you brought up a good point with the, it just in terms of reconciling with yourself. I don't know. I was like I work with the youth a lot, and we're coming to a point where the young people are no longer affected by residential schools.
Uh-huh.
And what I mean by that is directly, like indirectly, yes, we have our problems, but all we ever do is hear the stories and read the books. It hasn't been personally experienced by us as a generation, so it's basically, it's kind of, we're at a turning point right now. Our parents or grandparents, they're at that point where they can't reconcile with the government, but the younger generation is at that point, just because we haven't experienced it. We don't know what it felt like. So as long as the stories are recorded...
You don't feel like the fact that you've lost your language, that you're not affected?
No, not really.
That's a huge, major effect of the residential schools. I asked you at the top of the show if you knew your language, and you said no.
No, I don't. And I'm quite proud of that. I'm an urban indigenous person.
That's part of the genocide. It's a cultural genocide. If they're not, like, physically killing people, they're doing everything in their means to... Like, maybe you don't... I mean, I can't speak for you, but, like, I think that to speak for all the urban youth, native youth, to say that they're not affected by the residential schools is a bit of a stretch.
It's a huge stretch, actually.
Indirectly,
like if you have
indirectly
parents
yes.
that had parent, like some people, these parents were in residential school, or even if it was just their grandparents. But there's the 60s scoop. There's the whole removal of children from families in love in a whole different setting.
And there's still the
and
continued
it's still going on
of child apprehension. You know,
yeah.
Like it's amazing that how much our people continue to go through. And, yeah, we've touched on a lot of, like, really touchy situations here, right? I mean, I haven't heard people from your generation say that they haven't been affected by residential school. I have never heard anybody say that they're proud that they lost their language. Never. First time in my life ever.
Urban indigenous is a big difference.
There is a big difference, but, yeah, there is, yeah. But you know what? It's okay, right, that you
like
said that?
A,
there's a lot
have,
of... I've heard people say that they didn't want to go to a protest or go to, like, the powwow night because it's too Indian for them.
Yeah.
Well, that is a simulation,
I have
right?
something to say to that, too, is, like... Sorry.
It's okay.
I have to say it.
Yeah, yeah. You're more Indian than
I'm
most.
Not more Indian.
No.
I'm not. I'm mostly Irish. I'm French. I'm German. And I only recently found out that I have, like, you know, a pinky of Indian blood, maybe, if that. Like, my grandma's grandma was part. But I'm just... I think that that there needs to be, like, a lot more mutual understanding, not just between Native people, but between Native and
yeah.
non-Native.
And the urban Indians and the res
and
Indians,
the res,
as
yeah.
you've just identified.
Yeah.
It's not either or. We are all one,
yeah,
apparently,
we're all
and
one.
That is what we're striving for. You know, but these are the difficulties we face, right? There are some that don't want to be Indian. There are some who just can't live without being Indian and identifying themselves with that. And
I don't think being Indian is banging a drum and practicing ceremony. Like, you're Indian, Aboriginal, whether you are. It's something that you just grow up with. It's the values that you hold. It's not the ceremonies that people hold up on pedestals. It's not going to powwows. Those are great community building exercises, but it's not who we are as a person, as a nation. So that's just what I believe.
Well, okay. So interesting talk here we're having on language to language about being urban Indian, being a res Indian, being in solidarity with others, trying to reconcile with yourself and others as we try to stand in solidarity with each other. It's been a really interesting conversation, you know, like it's been one of the best conversations I've had in a long time. You got my mind is just thinking. And I like it. It's good. So did you know that CITR is doing a fundraiser?
Yes, we're trying to get $35,000.
$35,000 to hear talk like this,
we're
right?
Only $10,000
different opinions.
Off,
so. Only $10,000
off. So you could be really a great contributor and help us reach our goal.
Yeah, we might even bang a drum for you if you give us a call here. $10,000. Well, get me to bang a drum. Maybe even Ambrose, say? Yeah? Yeah? Would you bang on a drum for $10,000, Ambrose?
$10,000, yeah.
Come on.
I know you would. I
love the drum. I don't know my language either.
Yeah.
And I grew up as an adopted person, somebody that is from the 60s scoop. And one of the things that I think that we are in danger of, too, as we try to do all of these things within our community, is that we're going to have mixed bags of people representing.
Mm-hmm.
People who don't know their language are afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know their culture are afraid of it. Don't know their family are afraid of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then we'll have those people speaking on our behalf.
Yeah.
Right? They appear to be Native, look Native, even maybe sound a little bit Native. You know, I'm
but
one of those people.
That doesn't make them any less Aboriginal or First Nations. It's just the system they grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not their fault. I mean, they might be educated. I mean, like, everything in politics is stats-driven.
Yeah.
So if you can have people that know that system and can work within it,
mm-hmm.
to better First Nations, I think it's...
Kill the beast from within its
exactly.
belly, so to speak.
Yeah.
I have conflicting feelings about many things because I know in my heart that some things just aren't right, and that's a lot of the things the government are doing. I know they're not right, but again, unless we're going to have, like, the whole system just totally topple over and have to start from scratch again. We do kind of have to work with the system that's in place. And I think infiltrating the system is a good way. And that's why I really want to get everyone involved in that. We're all one and on the same, get this, the mutual understanding. And a lot, like I've been involved in some solidarity marches, and then now there's, I've helped with Idle No More, and now there's this worldwide thing, and it's not just a native thing. I mean, sure, there's some local people that represent the territories that are around Vancouver, Coast Salish, that come and they sing and they drum because they're proud of their culture, but that doesn't mean that these are solely, you know, native only events. It's for everyone. It's for all people that live here. And it's a worldwide, they're worldwide events. So if you don't live here, you can find one where you are or create your own.
Another question, have either one of you been invited to or challenged for the winter challenge? Do you know much about that?
Oh gosh, someone sent me an email.
Uh-oh, do you have to jump in the lake or something?
Well, apparently, but it wasn't public, so I don't have to do it. It was email.
Oh, you gotta do it.
I have to?
Do it.
Oh, you know, I already did it.
What did you do?
Well,
jump in the bathtub?
I jumped in, I did it in I actually went to a sweat and I jumped in the snow and then I jumped in the river, and that was in January. So I already did the challenge and no one had to challenge me. I did it because I wanted to.
Well, I was looking on Facebook. People like Mandy Nahani have done the challenge. Right. Delia Nahani. Let's see. I haven't seen anybody from Musqueam jumping into the Fraser River yet. But Kat Norris has been challenged.
Oh, actually, my roommate Melanie did.
Uh-huh. Melanie LaCroix.
Lyle.
Oh, Lyle. I know Melanie. I love her. Tell us about Melanie, because she just kind of slipped through the cracks here, yet she did this major thing. She did it.
I can't tell you everything about Melanie, but I know she's really awesome.
She does lots.
I don't want to speak for her, because I'm not that knowledgeable in all the great things she's doing, so I wouldn't want to.
I think she did a savory chicken pot pie dish, and it was on TV.
Oh, cool.
She was on TV. She was on the Food Channel, Food Network, and representing the people. It was really interesting. Okay, so we're asking you for funds. You got to hear a lovely lady, and her name is Shannon
Hecker,
and she's an anthropology student at UBC, and she's involved in many organizations.
And I'm just about to graduate too.
Well, congratulations!
Yes.
That's awesome, right here at UBC. And on May 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, she is organizing a worldwide family gathering in solidarity.
Well, there's two. Like, there's the worldwide march. I didn't create it. It was created. It's already happening, and I just jumped on and helping organize for the what's going on here in Vancouver, Coast Salish territory. There's also another event that we created, a worldwide family gathering on June 14th. And the idea behind that is actually quite, I'd say it's almost kind of revolutionary in the sense that we're calling on neighborhoods worldwide to get together and break bread, have a picnic, have a potluck, and in those local contexts, start talking about issues that your local community is facing. They could be related globally, but really, like, what can we do? We can sit and cry about all the injustices of the world, until we die. Or we could, you know, live one day at a time and actually start making change where we live with the people that we're surrounded by. And that's how solidarity starts, to me, anyways.
Mm-hmm. Great. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Ambrose?
No.
No? Are you done with us?
One last thing.
Hey.
You'll like this.
Yeah.
There's tomorrow night at the SFU Harbor Center, there is an event, and it is women leading anti-imperialist movements meeting. So all those leading ladies out there who want to make the world a better place and you know, stop imperialistic endeavors, join us.
All right. Any contact information for you in solidarity with all land defenders?
That's a page on Facebook. Uh-huh. My name's Shannon Hecker. You can add me as your friend or send me a message, email.
Yeah.
So.
And Ambrose, how about Alive? Is there any contact information for Alive and your new up and coming events?
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook. We've got the one event, Impeach Sean Atleo. It's an online discussion forum. It's not really an event. We're just trying to stimulate the conversation mm-hmm. in terms of off-reserve populations mm-hmm. and how does a system without the FN look like.
Right. Interesting stuff. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk to you again with some follow-ups in the near future. This is Language to Language, 101.9 FM.
Okay. That was fun.
It was fun. Sorry, I was so ridiculous.
Major broadcasting corporations.
I want CITR.
Dead.
I want CITR.
His family. Dead.
I want a radio station.
Burnt to the ground. I want to go to
Vancouver, BC.
I want to piss on his ashes.
Was given an opportunity they thought they would never get.
It's UBC. It says here that they want to give us a new radio station.
But they were up against one major problem.
How are we going to pay to move all our stuff into the new radio station?
CITR Radio presents the 2014 Fund Drive, a heartwarming story of compassion and generosity.